This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time. All right, Kate, welcome to the show.
What are we talking about today, Catherine?
Well, we're talking about something that I didn't really understand when you were talking about it before, but now I feel like I actually do. And this is the story behind the story. So the most asked question that you get asked, aside from what's the book about, in the lead up to a book coming out, is how did the book come about?
Mm-hmm.
Am I right?
You are completely right.
So with regard to skylarking, 25 words or less, what's the story you tell about how skylarking came to be?
I accidentally stumbled upon a grave. I didn't mean to write a novel. I did a lot of research. I was with my best friend. I found out about the story of these two girls and the terrible thing that happened. And then I stumbled my way forward into a publishing deal.
And how much of that is actually true?
Well, I think the way that we tell stories is that there's an essence of truth, right, in all of the parts. So all of the parts separately, if you took them out and examined them, you're like, yeah, right, you camped next to a grave, you were with your best friend, you kind of stumbled into a publishing deal. But I think it's the stuff that you leave out that is actually much more truthful. And I think it's not true that I so accidentally stumbled upon something and accidentally wrote a book. Like, of course I knew I was writing a book. Like,
I remember you saying that though. Like, I can remember that.
Yeah. And actually, I think that it was a piece that I put up for Writers Group, and you all said to me, you are downplaying the fact that this was actually a whole lot of hard work, because I had so internalized the story of this being like an accidental publication, because that is what I had pitched over and over again to people. And you know, it happens accidentally. You've already worked this out. It kind of happens because people push the story back at you. You learn what resonates with people or what people ask you all the time. And you also legitimately forget.
Absolutely.
And you don't remember the timeline. And I think we've talked about this before. I've said I've now got a 100,000 word document that I have journaled the entire process of writing this second book, partly so that I remembered what happened in what order, and so that I could go back and say, oh, you know what? That is when I decided I would get on the boat and go to Darwin or to Indonesia, or that is when I decided I needed to get some other input, or, oh, look, I'd made that decision before I was influenced by that book, because I think that...
So that is important to you?
It's important to me now because I'm super aware that I told a story that I thought served me, and I'm a writer, you know, like that's my business, that's what I do, but it hasn't always served me. And I think the stories that we tell ourselves over and over again are really powerful and potentially, and I've done a lot of work on this, like I've done mentorship with Charlotte Wood, which has been amazing. And we worked on some of these kind of ideas as well, that to keep on telling myself and other people the story that I accidentally stumbled upon a book and accidentally kind of wrote it and was really, really lucky that it ever came out into the world meant that I couldn't face the world with such confidence as a writer, because I didn't kind of believe that myself.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, so I think that part of it is, oh, ha-ha, we're made to do this marketing thing. And part of it is this really powerful narrative that we end up selling as part of ourselves.
But it's also interesting because, you know, first novels are, there's always that thing about them being so biographical. But your novel is different because it's based on historic events. So it sort of necessarily... There's an absence of you in that story in
that's
some
true.
Ways.
Not that that means people don't always look for you in the story,
true.
Which is what I'm sure they will do for you too. Can you do the same story for yourself in 25 words or less?
Yep.
Can you do it?
Yep. So I'm an engineer. I work in sewerage. I got a job for a while working at a council, fish out of water, met a very tyrannical senior citizen who was a president of this club and just was kind of mesmerized by her, wrote a short story, the short story became a novel.
And so how much of that, Catherine, is really true?
Yeah. Well, it's all true. It's, what's the Jeanette Winterson? All of it and none. You know, everything is true and nothing is.
Yeah.
I am an engineer. I do work in Surrey. You know, yes, all of those things definitely happened. And I do remember there being a moment when I met this president of the Senior Citizens Club. And I would, in all honesty, say that I, you know, I would put the time that I met her and the time that I met my husband as two moments in time that I knew life was going to change.
Yeah, wow.
Like,
that's
I really would. Yeah. And it did. I did originally write a short story, but the short story evolving to a novel is a very, very simplified version of what really happened. I guess some of it for me is around the story is the sewage engineer is a really interesting part. It's an unusual thing.
Absolutely. A point of difference.
And so I even think like last week with Text, we went out and did, so there's some publicity happening, an interview I'd done with the Herald Sun and with the Australian. I mean, they were just interesting. I guess interviews are interesting anyway, but I had prepped. This is sort of a side story to a side story, but I had prepped all about the book. This is what I'll talk about. This is how, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I think one of the first questions that I was asked was, what was your childhood like? Which is...
You're not expecting that.
No, not at all. And it's that moment where you realise you are part of the story.
Yeah.
But also, so then I went with Text and a photographer to one of the treatment plants that, you know, for the company that I work for, the Water Corporation. And got photos, you know, standing.
Doing what you do every day, right?
Doing what I do. Yeah. Well, this is the thing. So I work in sewerage, but I am office based. Like I'm, you know, the pipe will go from A to B, you know, it'll be pressure or it'll be gravity.
So you don't normally wear a hard hat.
There's no hard hats. There's no, you know, I like the comforts of my office.
Offices don't make great photos.
No, they do not make great photos. And, you know, to the extent that I got lost driving to this place, like it was a 4-minute drive and I probably took 35 minutes taking wrong turns and all the rest of it. So, you know, there's a degree to which, yes, part of that is true, but that is also a complete fabrication.
How do you think you're going to deal with it going forward?
Yeah, I think over time, and it's just reflecting on what you're saying, I suppose the story, the origin story of a book maybe is more important the first time round because you're, you know, and the story of the author is probably more important because, you know, you're coming out of nowhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think over time the view becomes more nuanced.
And you get to make the point that you are intentionally investing in the story of your next books, you know, whereas I think that there is this element with the first time and the debut that, oh, this is how I went from my amazing, interesting other life to this amazing, interesting life of being a writer and that publishing houses and the media and book sellers and book purchasers need that hook to get them in.
And it's also... You have to make that, to start to write a novel, you have to make a conscious decision that that is something you want to do, can do. Like it takes a while to own that, you know, like I told so many people I was just doing some fictitious university assignment for a year. I wasn't studying at the time. I wasn't doing anything, but that was a justifiable pursuit where it felt very strange to say, oh, I'm just working on my novel.
It makes you really vulnerable too.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think the interesting thing too is that we're obviously being really uber conscious about this and thinking about it because we're talking about it a lot for the podcast and we're talking to people about it. But that it also can manifest just as a weirdness, a weird feeling for writers as they embark on this for the first time that you might not be able to articulate necessarily what all that weirdness is, but that it's some of this splitting of the personality.
Yeah, public and private personas too in some ways, isn't it?
Who it is. Tricky stuff.
Shall we get on with the show?
Let's get on with the show. In this episode, I speak to Penny Russin about her creative process, including her different experiences of publishing books 14 years apart and how she combines motherhood and her writing practice. Today, I have the very great pleasure of welcoming Melbourne writer Penny Russin to The First Time.
Penny Russen grew up in Tasmania and now lives on the outskirts of Melbourne with her partner, three children and her dog, Swoozie, and luckily, very close to me. Penny's first book, Undine, was published in 2004 and her latest, her ninth, The End Sister, was released earlier this year in 2018. Among the many accolades her work has received are the New South Wales Premier's Literary Prize, the Western Australia Premier's Book Award, an Aurealis Award, and a number of notable CBCA Book Awards. Penny also teaches writing at the University of Melbourne and is currently completing her PhD, looking at the application of comics in online therapy for young people. Welcome, Penny.
Hi, Kate.
Penny, it's been 14 years since your first book, Undine, was published.
Good grief.
Good grief. I'm pretty sure that you won't have forgotten what publication day was like, though. Can you remember?
I can remember. So I was living in a flat in Brighton that was above an architect's office. It was like the crappiest flat in all Brighton, but it was like a beautiful spot. It was near the library and near the water. And I had a 1-year-old daughter, Frederique, and I was still a new enough mother that I still woke up every day feeling like it was Christmas just because I had this baby. And so Undine kind of was published in the midst of that. And I was actually kind of a bit oblivious to publication day. Like I sort of, you know how they always say publication day is like the 1st of September or whatever, and then it actually comes into the shops like a week beforehand. Yeah. So this was kind of before I was on the internet, but it was before, you know, Instagram and Facebook and those really immediate kind of ways of communicating with each other. So I don't know, it just kind of appeared in the shops and somehow I became aware that it was in the shops and I went and looked at it and that was all very exciting. I'd worked as an editor, so I'd already had that experience of going into a shop and seeing a book that I'd worked on being in the shop. So it was exciting, but it wasn't entirely a new experience. What I do remember is whenever I went out with Frederique, I wanted to tell everybody that I'd written a book. And whenever I went out without Frederique, I wanted to tell everybody that I had a baby. So my identity was really split between the book and the baby. And the other thing I remember is that the little funny, you know, free local newspaper in Brighton actually reviewed Undine, which at the time I just went, oh, okay, that's nice. Of course it did or whatever. But now I realise that was incredibly lucky and fortunate that they happened to pick up that book and review it. And they didn't know that I lived locally. I didn't do anything to kind of, you know, get my name out there or. And the woman who worked in the architect's office downstairs, the receptionist, saw it and was really excited. And she was the one who showed it to me. So that was really nice.
So you're doing this with your 1-year-old. How did you write the book with Frederique? Or was it already done before she was born?
I had written a whole draft of it before I got pregnant with Freddie and it was a mess. And then I redrafted it during the pregnancy with the birth as the kind of like the ultimate deadline.
I have to be done.
Yeah. So I rewrote it and I think I finished pretty close to when she was born. And interestingly, I had been working at Allen & Unwin as a baby editor while I was writing Undine, and people at Allen & Unwin had seen bits of it and liked it and given me sort of like positive and also negative feedback. And I'd kind of reworked based on that. But I think while I was pregnant with Freddie, Eva Mills, who was like the editorial assistant at Allen & Unwin when I started there, got a job at Random House as a commissioning editor. And so Undine ended up being published by Eva at Random House. I think it was pretty much the first book that she signed. So I signed the contract, I think, within a month or so of Freddie being born. So it was completely like I just didn't know what was going on. You know, I only had half a brain.
As one does at that time. So you said you knew a little bit about what it looked like for a book to come out in the world from your experience in publishing. What had you picked up already at that stage about what first-time writers did right or what they did wrong?
Yeah, I think I didn't really have very much of an idea about those things. Like I kind of knew what happened in the publishing house up to that point where a big box of books arrived. And then I had no idea. Like then it just sort of like, except for, you know, walking into a shop and kind of rearranging the books so that the books that I'd worked on faced outwards. And so, you know, if you're an author, know that your editors are also going out there and doing that for you. That there is a team of little elves going around facing your book forwards. But yeah, so I didn't really know how first time authors were promoting themselves or what could be done to sort of help the book out into the world.
The Ancestor has come out this year. What are the immediate differences in your experience of Undine coming out into the world and you walking around with this 1-year-old child and what it's been like this year?
First of all, I guess one of the exciting things about The Ancestor was that I knew that it was being published into a readership that already existed for it. Like I knew that other writers, that there were people kind of waiting for it. Like so that was pretty exciting.
Exciting, not scary?
Exciting. Okay. Yeah. I think I'm sort of past the point of being scared. Yeah.
About what the readers will expect. Yeah. It's not intimidating for you
it's
knowing that there's readers
expecting
something from you.
Thinking, I think because as well, like, you know, I felt pretty confident with The Ancestor that there were things about it to love. I know that there are flaws. I know that there are, I mean, I've had people say to me that there are a few grammatical errors and stuff in there.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, well, when I received Drift, which was my third book, I immediately opened it up to a random page and there were all these, like, every piece of dialogue had an adverbial tag on it. So, you know, she said wildly, he said angrily, and I was just like, slammed the book shut and I've never looked at it again.
Oh, my goodness.
Ancestor, I was excited because I knew there was a readership waiting for it. I knew that it wasn't just being kind of like thrown into a big hole in the immediate short-term future. I also know that that hole is already starting to grow, that there's the sinkhole of books that will draw it in. It's no longer on the new bookshelves in the libraries and that sort of thing. It's like, you know, it was published in February, which is a millennia ago in publishing. It won't be eligible for any of the awards kind of shortlists or anything until next year, which is a huge relief because I hate that shortlist season. I hate the whole process of being shortlisted. And now that I've actually had the experience of winning some awards, which happened with Only Ever Always, which was my 8th book, even winning awards, I'm very ambivalent about.
And this is really hard, particularly in the area that you write for, because you've got the CBCAs every year, as well as a range of other awards that you can be nominated for. And you, as you say, you've had that experience many times over. How do you deal with the day, with the shortlist day, especially now with social media? How do you do it all?
The years that I am not up for an award, I will often make commentary on the shortlists. I'll notice the things that I think should be on the list that aren't on the list. And I'll congratulate the people who are shortlisted, and I'll be very conscious and aware of what is being shortlisted and contributing to a conversation about it. The years that I might be on the shortlist, I tend to not be part of that conversation. I don't want to annoy anyone. I don't want to sound like I've got sour grapes if I haven't been shortlisted. The year Only Ever Always was, you know, won awards. It wasn't shortlisted for a CBCA and I was devastated. Like I cried and, you know, I told my mum and my mum was like, oh, well, better luck next time, because she doesn't really understand what it means, you know, that it's something that you work really hard for and it's really important as a writer to get that sort of recognition. And I was kind of devastated because it was the first time. It never occurred to me that Undine might be shortlisted for anything. I wasn't watching the lists. I didn't think about it. It got a notable for the CBCA and I was like, oh, okay, what's a notable? Like, didn't know. Whereas now I'm all too aware of it. But I also know that it's, you know, that there's lots of different reasons that a book might be left off a shortlist that has nothing to do with how good it is or how beautiful or moving or important it is. So yeah, basically radio silence when I am eligible for a shortlist.
Okay. You said before about how a book kind of disappears into a sinkhole a few weeks after publication or a time after publication. Have you found that time has changed since Undine was released and over the publication of your books?
Yeah, I do think it's shorter. I think that that the thing about social media is that there probably is a period where there is a much broader reach than there was before social media. But I think that then you're very aware of the fact that it stops being, you know, in that, you know, that it's no longer the focus of attention. Having said that, something I guess I know now compared to what I knew with Undine is that books have a strange life after that period. So people can talk to you about books that you've sort of forgotten about. They kind of reappear and they can have a sort of another life in, and they're going off and having little lives in the hearts and minds of readers all the time. And I think you slowly become aware that is still occurring.
You're writing into a YA and middle grade audience. How would that differ perhaps from how someone who's writing adult fiction might publicise their work in terms of your work is going into schools, it's going out with librarians?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that happens with books for young people is that teachers' notes will be produced. And so you kind of have this double audience, I suppose. You have the audience of the parents and teachers and the adult kind of gatekeepers, and then you have the audience, the direct audience of the readers themselves, which in YA is children but is also adults. It's a complex kind of notion of audience on the one hand and genre on the other. Even for middle grade, which is what I would say Ancestor is, I get the people that write to me are usually adults who've read it. And often you don't, unless you're going into schools and doing talks, and even then often you go to schools where they haven't necessarily, you're just going as a children's author or as a young adult author, so they haven't read a particular book. But yeah, you don't often get that direct access to your reader in the same way. Kids, I think, will be a little bit more inclined to write fan mail. Teenagers are often very reluctant to reach out to the authors that they love, though I've had a few incredibly loyal and sweet fans over the years, but they grow up and then they stop writing to you as well. So it's a kind of mixed audience that you're marketing yourself to, and sometimes that can be quite a bit of a cognitive sort of leap to go from marketing yourself directly to kids and teenagers and marketing yourself to adults. I sometimes actually think that the books that I write are more for adults, even though they're very distinctly within the genre of children's and young adult. I feel like I write quite experimental books, and I feel like those experiments occur for adults to reflect more on the nature of children's literature and young adult literature. So it's not that I want to exclude a young audience, because I'm always writing for the young person that I was. And so I'm always writing for a particular type of reader, but it's not the every reader. I'm not trying to reach a mass market of young people. I'm trying to reach those people who need that book in their lives.
Did you have, Undine is part of the first in a trilogy. Did you have the whole concept of the entire narrative arc sketched out in your head when you began?
No. So what happened with Undine is I got to the end and two things happened. One was there's a character called Max in Undine. And at the end, one of the pieces of editorial feedback was, you know, we need to know more about Max and what Max's motivations are. And the other thing that happened was that I got a phone call saying the Americans want to sign a two-book contract with you. Random House wants to sign a two-book contract, so that would be three books, including Undine. And this is from Eva, and she said, I have fallen in love and I'm getting married and I'm leaving. And so I won't be at Random House anymore. So I knew that I would want to follow Eva wherever she went, which turned out to be back to my true home, Allen and Unwin. So I'm very grateful for that. But I also knew that that would be the opportunity. If I was ever going to write sequels to Undine, then that was the time to do it. That those three books that I'd be writing for Random House could be three Undine books, and I could take on that question of who is Max, which is pretty much what Breathe is about. And so then I had to kind of think about what happens in a sequel and how, you know, characters that at the end of Undine, the characters are still very much in flux. At the end of Breathe, one of the characters in particular, Trout, is kind of finished. He's kind of done. He's kind of worked his shit out. And so I sort of had to break him a little bit again in Drift by giving him what he always wanted and letting him realise that that isn't necessarily what he wants. So It was challenging. It was challenging to kind of then reconstruct, sort of reconstruct Undine as I wrote Breathe and Drift and work out what Undine was really about in a bigger world.
Were you able to do that quite quickly? Like, what was that process like then, delivering those two books?
So Undine came out in 2004 and Breathe came out in 2005. Breathe came out in the same month
quick.
That Una came out. So Una is my second child. So I gave birth to Una on the 28th of September and the publication date for Breathe was October. You've in the same year.
Clearly got some synergy with the creative process in the pregnancy.
Luckily I stopped having like a baby per book because I think that would have been quite unsustainable.
Crazy.
But yeah, so and then Drift was about 15 months after or 18 months after. So it was not the next year, but early in the following year that Drift came out, 2007. So
did having that contract and that delivery date along with the delivery date of your child, did that ensure that those books were done?
It was very motivating. And also I was incredibly motivated by needing money. So I had signed contracts and I really needed the rest of the money. So I had to finish the books. My partner, Martin, was working part-time when Freddie was born. He decided to go down to part-time so that he could be around more. And then when Una was born, he decided to go to full-time study, which we kind of did on the giddy optimism of the advance from the American sales of Undine and Breathe. And so it was money really that motivated me. And I guess also a lot of Undine and Breathe is about and Drift is about change. It's about physical change and psychological change and growth and all the things that were actually happening to me in my own body and my own life. I just kind of repurposed and put into, because I think being a mother and being a teenager is not that different. Being a mother of young children, you know, you suddenly, on the one hand, you feel like you have all this control in your life, and on the other hand, you feel like you have no control. You feel powerful and you feel powerless. You feel subject to your body, like subject to the changes, as though, you know, you feel that lack of control of your body, and yet you're in awe of your body and you're amazed by what it can do. And I think that's really what Undine is all about. There's a lot of the body in Undine.
You were writing those three books with very small children, and you've managed to sustain your career over these 14 years. How on earth, really, have you done that?
That's a really good question, and I don't quite know the answer. I know that I am really, really, really happy to have a messy house. I have been really good in the past at not getting involved in, you know, social circles at school, particularly when the girls started school at St. Andrew's Primary, which was a tiny primary school. The other mums at that school were actually already pretty close. They had older kids already at the school. Freddie was the only firstborn that year. And so I really was quite distant from the other school parents, which was out of necessity. I have found it harder as the kids have gotten older. It was easier when they were little. I've found I could put them to bed and forget about them. You know, once they were asleep, they were gone. Once they were at childcare or whatever. I feel like now that they're older, the demands of parenting are much more complex and probably more burdensome on my imagination and my interior life. I worry more, which, you know, uses up some of my what-if engine, I guess.
You combine teaching as well as studying yourself with the writing. What does teaching give you?
Teaching gives me permission to experiment and to approach writing in the same way as I did when I was new at it. Being in that classroom environment, I find really inspiring because I can see people, A, not afraid to try something that's never been done before, but B, actually not afraid to try things that have been done before. And I think as a writer, you feel like you need to be constantly new and renewing yourself and renewing the art. And sometimes actually the best stories are those stories that that are very classic or very, you know, tried and true and deserve to be told again and again and again. So, I feel like it kind of, it just sort of keeps me humble as a writer, really.
Do you feel that the expectations of emerging writers have changed over the time you've been teaching or changed since you were first published?
I feel like there's more opportunities for emerging writers. Actually, I feel like emerging writer wasn't an identity when I started. Yep. There wasn't really such a thing as emerging writers. And I feel like now there's an enormous pressure to, I guess, be emerging and how long you're emerging for. It's a little bit like that, like, when do you say you're an adult?
Yes.
You know, it's like, I don't know that having this category is necessarily useful. I remember getting really angry about the massive grant that at one stage, I don't know if it still exists, that Australia Council were giving people for their second books. Because I felt like it was a really unrealistic idea of how it worked, how being a writer works. It's not that, you know, you get two books out there and then you're done. You've finished, you know, I think we're all constantly emerging all the time. And so, yeah, there's this kind of, I don't know, there's a precociousness that we expect of emerging writers. And if they're not precocious and immediately successful, there's almost a temptation to sort of say, oh, well, they're not really writers. But like, I was reading about Jane Gardam today, and she didn't publish her first book till she was in her late 30s. And she's published like a billion books.
I want that so much. Just keep publishing. A long apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Penny, what advice do you give to the students that you teach, the writers that you teach? What's the key advice, I suppose?
It's not even advice. I foster optimism. And because I honestly believe that if I can be a writer, anyone can be a writer. Like, I don't feel like at any stage I was deputized. I don't feel like there was anything special about the way that I was brought up or the school that I went to. I mean, I went to a public school in Tasmania. Lots of the people I went to school with, you know, didn't have ambitions, though art was always fostered in the curriculum. But yeah, I felt like I had a pretty ordinary life and I became a writer. So it's really optimism, but also kind of, I guess, expectation management. So being optimistic, knowing that you can do it, but also, like, is this really the life you want? Like, there's things about it that do suck. And if you don't feel, if you're just here because you feel like writing was something you were always good at school, then there might be other things to do with that. So I don't know. It's kind of that, you know, managing your expectations, but keeping that sort of feeling of like, if I want this, I can have this. If it's that important and it's that necessary to me as a human, then I can make that happen with work.
Penny, through teaching and I know through social media as well and through your editing work, you're involved in the writing community a lot. How has that community helped you over your career?
I think that's the best thing about being a writer is the writing community. I love the friends and the connections I've made and that feeling of bondedness that we have with each other. And I've had so many excellent book recommendations and you know, I just feel like that's my growth, my professional growth is through those interactions. But also I think there's also just that normalizing, you know, kindness that we have for each other because we know how horrible it can be or how difficult it can be. We know how privileged and spoiled that sounds and yet, you know, how true and authentic those feelings are. So I think there's a kindness that you can't necessarily get from people who don't have a creative life and aren't trying to balance those things.
How do you recommend people become involved in those communities? Like, if you're someone who's sitting on the outside going, I'm not a writer yet, I don't know who to make writer friends with, how do you recommend you do it?
After Undine was published, the CYL threw a kind of professional development day for writers to learn how to give talks at schools. And I went to that professional development day and Kate Constable was there. And I'd never met her, but I knew that she'd written a book with a character called Trout in it. And Eva had told me that that trout was quite similar to my trout.
Destiny.
And I knew that she lived in Preston and she lived in Thornbury then and I lived in North Fitzroy. So we were close. She had a kid. So I went up to her and I said, I think we should be friends. honestly, it was like that gormless. And she was like, sure. And we caught the tram home and we became friends. And we actually had lots of days of sitting in sort of like, we're both tired and brain fried. We're both a bit socially awkward because we're both writers, you know, people who would choose to write and read over going to a party or something. So we had days where we would sit there in silence, but we would just tolerate the kind of the newness of the relationship and the uncomfortableness of getting to know each other, because we knew there was a greater good. And so after that experience, I've always been like, I'm just going to talk to people, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook or face-to-face. It's just about, it's about that really authentic connection. And it's not even a strategy. It's just knowing that people are people and it's worth having those conversations and connecting with others.
Over time, I imagine that you've had a chance to reflect on what success looks like for you with your books, whether it's response from the readers or book sales or prizes. Have you come to some pearl of wisdom about what success is for you, or does it change?
I think success for me is being able to keep doing it. So having that knowledge that whenever I write something, someone will probably publish it, is, or, you know, or at least help me turn it into something that could be published. I like the idea of people knowing my name, knowing who I am. I like the idea of people saying, oh, it's a Penny Russin book. But it's to me, really success, like I'm not very good at the commercial side, at the, you know, pushing myself as a writer. And to me, that success still really comes from one reader, one moment. You know, I went and did a book club and there was a group of like grade 3-4s who'd read N Sister were there, and one of them said, can I read you my favourite part?
Oh.
And that was like, I mean, I think that was like the best moment of my writing life, sitting there listening to her reading her favourite part to me and thinking and remembering how crucial and important books are in the lives of children, and being present for that was, yeah, that was such a privilege.
What's got easier and what's got harder?
Writing has gotten harder.
Don't say that, Penny. Don't tell us that.
It's writing has gotten harder because I'm not very good at letting myself make a mess. I feel like I feel very risk averse. After Only Ever Always, which took 4 years to write and was such a messy book to write, I almost had like a sort of post, I don't want to use the word traumatic because that's belittling of people who've had actual trauma, but it was a similar kind of physiological response of the anxiety whenever I was confronted with the blank page, not wanting to put a word wrong, not wanting to make any mistakes. So that has become harder. But what's become easier, I think, is probably talking, like, calling myself an author, talking about books. I feel comfortable with my identity as a writer now. I don't feel like an imposter anymore. I don't feel like a fake. I feel certain about who I am as a writer.
What book does that come in on? What number book? Is there hope for all of us?
That was probably winning the awards probably actually gave me that validation. Sort of like, right, that's it. You know, like I'm doing something that other people are accepting and recognising. Though also I went to New Zealand with Kate Constable once. We went off to be writer ladies with hats and suitcases, and we had a conversation about what do you write on the customs form, yeah, with occupation. And she was like, I write author. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to write author too, because I've had as many books published as you have. And that was probably a bit of a kick in the pants.
Yeah.
Of like, you are. Just say you are, because you are.
Own it.
Yeah.
Penny, can you recommend a debut book to us?
So one of my absolute favourite authors is Jane Gardam, and one of my absolute favourite books of hers is A Long Way from Verona, which is her, I've just discovered, was her debut. It's sometimes marketed as young adult now, but it wasn't. It was written as an adult book, and it's a Künstlerroman, which is a German word, of course.
Of course.
For a coming of age of the artist. You know, it's like, wow, the Bildungsroman, but it's specifically about becoming an artist. And it starts with her kind of saying that she's a very odd person because she had this violent experience when she was 9. And then at the end of that chapter, that violent experience is you know, she's had a writer come to the school and give a talk about writing. She's gone home and grabbed all the things that she's ever written and she's shoved it in his car as he's driving away. And then he writes to her and says, you know, you are a writer. And it's just like the dream narrative of a 9-year-old who wants to write.
Wonderful. Thank you. Penny, Catherine's about to embark on all of this for the very first time. What advice can you give her to keep her head and to keep grounded through all of what's coming up?
Anything you're feeling, other people have felt before. And that sort of that model of self-compassion where you recognize that what you're feeling is a human feeling, that other people have felt it before, being kind to yourself and patient. I mean, it's really important to just be with yourself and be your best reader, you know, have faith in the book that you're putting out there and know that you're not trying to sell someone something they don't need. You know, you're actually, when you're promoting your work, you're actually giving them a product that they can't get anywhere else. It's something special and unique and good and wholesome. You're trying to give them a nurturing, you know, meal or something that will make their lives better.
That's wonderful advice. Thank you for sharing it with us and for being with us on the first time.
My pleasure.
Penny, I'm going to ask you our first time quick five, and we're going to ask this for your first book, Undine. For Undine, were you agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territories or just Australia, New Zealand?
It did sell into America.
Only America?
Yes.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
CYL had me come and talk about Undine.
And do you know how many copies you have sold?
I think it's about, in Australia, it's about 7,000, I think.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much. To find out more about Penny Russin's books and writing, check out our show notes on thefirsttimepodcast.com. Also, don't forget to rate and review us wherever you're listening to your podcasts. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre and RMIT School of Media and Communication.